that bad. Now the boat won't float, I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore.
Folks, welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in the air, listener-supported community radio station, WEFT in Champaign. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Area Incorporated. Now here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois' Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois' Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. So, so what's been happening this week, Gus?
Oh, well, of course, everybody knows right now the big thing happening is the 50th anniversary of the not necessarily the signing of it, but implementation of Medicare. Mm-hmm. This is such a monumental event, and a lot of people don't really know a lot about how this bill came to be and what it has done you know, looking at the data and looking at the actual history behind it and the current struggles around Medicare. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I thought we'd take this first part to really just go into a really a good detailed history and also the current struggle of what's going on with Medicare and what it really means for the everyday people.
Yes, indeed. Can I ask you a question right off the bat, though, sure. As a historian? Now, from my understanding, during the Franklin Delano Roosevelt New Deal era and stuff, that this was – they wanted to implement that back then along with Social Security, mm-hmm. but there was forces that prevented it. And then I understand that Harry Truman wanted to implement it in like 48, I think it was. And again, he was, you know, pushed back by certain special interests. So really it was about 30 years overdue when it did come into signing in 65.
Yeah, definitely. The biggest thing about it too, when they looked at Roosevelt's plan during the New Deal, everybody was very conscious of saying that, oh, he's this big time socialist now. He wants to help the people. He wants to give them things. He wants to, you know, like, you know, their people are starving. They should pick themselves up and things like that. No, the New Deal plan and why it was not able to incorporate the Medicare bill when it was needed at that time was because Roosevelt was doing so many progressive things to try to alleviate the issues and crises going on with the everyday working class people in this country. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so unfortunately, it did come way too late. You know, I argue that it should have came with the creation of the U.S. Constitution. This idea, you know, like bodies break down, people get sick, people are born with ailments at birth. Mm-hmm. These are things that have to be addressed, and they should be free because that's a human right. If we're going to be a part of this country, we have to be healthy, and we have to be taken care of as healthy so-called citizens of the United States.
Indeed, even young people who think they don't really think much about health care, they have accidents, you know, skiing accidents, car accidents, they get illnesses that they contract. I mean, so it affects everybody.
So I was just going to go ahead and do just to kind of give people a scope of what we're talking about with Medicare. So what happened was President Lyndon Johnson signed Medicare, the National Health Insurance Program for Americans 65 years of age and older, into law on July 30th, 1965. The big day. Medicare and the accompanying Medicaid health program for the poor were the last major social reforms enacted in the U.S. and came at a time where there was an intense crisis for American capitalism. A lot of people don't really understand this when it comes to looking at capitalism and how it shifted to neoliberal global capitalism from industrial capitalism. But this was a pivotal moment because there were a major workers' movements outside of the civil rights movement, outside of the Black Power movement, that were existing in the United States and also across the seas. So there was this major upsurge of action and solidarity amongst workers in the 60s that was really a driving force behind the capitalists saying something is really going on here. So it was a turmoil like society at that time. Mm-hmm. So these are the things that were happening. And because of a lot of the groundwork that these groups were doing, we were able to push the Medicare bill to the front of the government's desk. So it wasn't a top down bill. A lot of people think that it was the Great Society and all this stuff was strictly a president, an executive thing, a government thing. No, it was because the people wanted it and they fought for it.
Well, you could say the same thing about FDR, can't you? In the 30s. I mean,
yeah,
really,
same thing.
His job, he wasn't a socialist. His basic mission was to save capitalism. And
exactly.
He had to do something, you know, because the country is on the verge. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but however, by today's standards, passages from the Democratic Party platform on which Johnson ran in 1964 sound radical. In a section titled The Individual, the platform reads, "The health of the people is important to the strength and purpose of our country and is a proper part of our common concern. In a nation that lacks neither compassion nor resources, the needless suffering of people who cannot afford adequate medical care is intolerable." That sounds like healthcare should be free. From that statement, anybody that is sick, born with some type of illness, or something happens to them, it should be taken care of by the government based off of that platform. But let's look at the history of this, though. Hostility from the start. Hostility has always existed against Medicare because the issue with Medicare, of course, well, first of all, what does Medicare do? As originally enacted, the program provided for inpatient hospital care, Part A, as well as certain outpatient services, Part B, including preventative services, ambulance transport, mental health, and other medical services. And Part B has always required a premium payment. Now, of course, from looking at this, we're looking at a lot of money that could be made if these things did not exist for people. So, again, hostility was early in the history of Medicare. Some of the leading Republicans were really, really vicious against it. Senator Barry Goldwater commented in 1964, having given our pensioners their medical care in kind, why not food baskets? Why not public housing accommodations? Why not vacation resorts? Why not a ration of cigarettes for those who smoke and a beer for those who drink?
Yeah, why not?
In 1964, future President George H.W. Bush denounced the impending Medicare bill as socialized medicine. While it was nothing of the sort, it was seen by many supporters as a first step towards establishment of universal health care. Despite its limitations, it is indisputable that the program has had an immense impact on the health and social well-being of the elderly population and people in general. And let me go to my data, and everybody knows me now. They know I love my data, and this proves what Medicare has done. Largely as a result of Medicare and improved medical technologies, life expectancy at age 60 increased from 14.3 years in 1960 to 19.3 years in 2012. Prior to Medicare, about half of America's seniors did not have hospital insurance. More than one in four elderly went without medical care due to cost, and one in three seniors lived in poverty. So some 53 million elderly are currently enrolled in Medicare today. Virtually all seniors have access to health care, and only about 14% live below the poverty line. Despite a relentless attack on Medicare services in recent years, Medicare is extremely popular, with 77% of Americans viewing it as a very important program that needs to be defended. Now, the program has been under assault from sections of the political establishment in corporate America, especially with neoliberal global capitalism.
Let's hear that again. 77%, of the American people think it needs to be protected?
77% of the American people support Medicare.
Yeah.
So whatever the 16 Republican presidential candidates are telling you out there is complete falsehood. Mm. People want Medicare. So again, in 1995, under the leadership of then House Speaker Newt Gingrich, Republicans proposed cutting 14% from projected Medicare spending and forcing millions of elderly recipients into managed health programs. The aim, in Gingrich's words, was to ensure that Medicare was going to wither on the vine. In the most open threat to private Medicare, in the spring of 2014, Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin, released a Path to Prosperity budget plan that slashed $5.1 trillion over 10 years. Key to his blueprint was the institution of what we call premium support in health care for seniors, essentially a voucher plan under which seniors could purchase either private insurance or Medicare coverage. So fast forward to the current presidential campaign that we're in now. Jeb Bush, Republican candidate, speaking at an event last week in New Hampshire, sponsored by the billionaire Koch brothers, said of Medicare, "We need to figure out a way to phase out this program and move to a new system that allows them, those over 65, to have something because they're not going to have anything." But Bush and others justify their proposals to privatize or outright abolish Medicare with claims that the program will be bankrupt in the near future. Let's bring some more data in. A recent report shows that projected Medicare spending will account for 6% of the gross domestic product by 2090. Down from earlier projections that it would make up 13% of the GDP in 2080. So again, what the Republican candidates are telling us about Medicare and about it hurting the economy is complete and utter garbage, and it's bipartisanship that to basically hurt the everyday people and to make money off of our illnesses and our sicknesses. Because what it shows is that Medicare is what the people want, and it doesn't hurt the economy. And by 2090, it still won't be hurting the economy.
Yeah. Well, also, like Medicare, like Social Security, self-financing, too.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, let's go back just a few years ago. I mean, this was unheard of, unthinkable for a Democratic president to actually propose, like President Obama did, about cutting Medicare and Social Security.
Yeah.
He appointed the Simpson-Bowles Committee, which let's do a little, who was Simpson and who was Bowles? Well, Alan Simpson is a Republican senator from, where's he from? Wyoming or Utah? But these people they've had a lifelong career of trying to just basically dismantle any kind of social programs and stuff, But basically what it is, since corporate America donates to the political campaigns of both Republicans and Democrats, you know, they're trying to serve their masters, you know,
exactly.
And Wall Street would love to get their hands on the Social Security money to invest it. And the big multi-billion-dollar healthcare, corporate healthcare industry in this country would love to have Medicare, Medicaid completely phased out, you know, so they can make more profits, you know.
Exactly.
What they were able to reap from the Affordable Care Act, basically the expansion of private health, you know, insurance in this country with no real public option. They want even more. That's just like greed is insatiable.
You know? Of course. And so the question is, where do we go from here?
Yes.
What does this history mean? Mm-hmm. And what do these processes mean? What does this struggle mean? Medicare is under attack. Healthcare in general is under attack. The Affordable Care Act did not do and is not going to do what we needed to do to protect the lives of everyday American people. Mm-hmm. So what we have to continue to do is when we do organize, when we do go out and we challenge our public servants, because that's what they're supposed to be. They're not supposed to be politicians or officials. They're supposed to be our public servants. We challenge them to make sure that we take that they take into account that health is the central focus of building any type of society, whether it be a political, economic, social, cultural progression. It comes from the health of the people, and we have to make sure that 77% grows to 80%, then 90% to 100%. And the only way we can do that is to educate the people about why Medicare is so important and why free healthcare needs to be the end all goal for health in this country.
Yes.
So we have to continue to organize this, and we have to use these histories and these pivotal moments like the 50th anniversary and make sure we're spreading these words across social media, newspapers, everywhere.
Yes.
Because this is a very pivotal time.
Yeah, and even at 77%, I mean, if people would just make this more of a priority issue,
exactly.
And basically say, you know, Republican or Democrat, if you vote to cut Medicare, then you're out. I mean, I'm not voting for you.
Exactly.
I mean, you can imagine how quickly
tolerance.
It would change. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
But, and sort of a follow-up thing here, Gus, I guess Thursday was a big day for healthcare justice movement in 69 cities around the nation. Activists celebrated the 50th anniversary of Medicare and rallied for its expansion to cover every single American. Medicare works, and it's time for policymakers to protect, improve, and expand it to create a single standard quality of care for everyone. And just like in every other industrialized country in the world except us, and even in some lesser developed countries. Thursday took the message to the streets with the National Nurses Union United leading the way, and the nurses were joined by thousands of other participants, including community activists, retirees, doctors, and union members from United Auto Workers, the APWU, the United Steelworkers, IOTC, ATU, Communication Workers of America, and NYSNA. The AFL-CIO unanimously endorsed Medicare for All message in its raising wages mobilization program, including the Champaign County Central Labor Council, also endorsed Thursday's actions. And these developments represented a sea change in labor support for single payer. More and more unions have realized that Obamacare isn't enough, and they're starting to devote serious resources to finishing the job. So in regards to this, I guess coming up here in Chicago, October 30th, November 1st, there's going to be a national single payer strategy conference in which our local state representative, Carol Ammons, is going to be attending.
Yeah, I'm so excited about this.
Yes.
This is going to be huge. Yeah.
You know, I'm on the National Labor Campaign for Single Payer Steering Committee, and there's a lot going on out there. I mean, especially in New York, Vermont, California, New Jersey, Washington, Oregon, and even Minnesota close by. Illinois is lagging. And Illinois, I mean, it's just, I don't understand why Illinois is lagging behind the rest of these states, but I can tell you that there's been a real reluctance for unions in the state of Illinois to get on board, other than the National Nurses Union. I mean, a lot of them talk the talk, but none of them will commit any time, resources, or anything else to do anything. You know, so that's part of the reason why, I'm letting you know a little secret here, part of the reason why they're having the national conference in Chicago, you know, trying to help kickstart Illinois, basically.
Good, yeah.
So, but we're going to take a quick music break, and we're going to be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on Listener Supported Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
1, 2... Same-sex marriage. Do you get sick to your guts? I mean, two people who want to commit to a stable, monogamous, lifelong relationship. What are they, nuts? It's unnatural. Oh, a man must never lie with a person who is a guy. He should only lie to his wife. The Bible is clear. We're defenders of marriage in three-button suits. We'll raise our double... feet are tired. Oh, my feet are tired, but my soul is rested. My feet are tired. My feet are tired. My feet are tired, but my soul is rested. 1955, that's a lifetime ago. Remember I like Ike, remember Jim Crow. Montgomery, Alabama, sleepy southern town. That woman started something when she sat down. My feet are tired. My feet are tired. My feet are tired, but my soul is rested. My feet are tired. My feet are tired. My feet are tired, but my soul is rested. Hundreds walk to work in the morning light. Thousands walking home from their jobs at night. The days turn to weeks, the weeks turn to months. It was more a year before it was one. My feet are tired. My feet are tired. My feet are tired, but my soul is rested. My feet are tired. My feet are tired. My feet are tired, but my soul is rested. Working back then, you would hear people say, I only want my kids to see a better day. I thought it over and I changed my mind. I wanna see freedom in my time. My feet are tired.
Okay, we're back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour. That was Ann Feeney, My Feet Are Tired. And, you know, interesting, she said she wrote that song during a march that Jesse Jackson had organized. And unfortunately, I can't remember what this was in regards to. But anyway, it was a huge turnout. And there was, I guess, but anyway, yeah, she was. She said during the march, her feet were getting so tired and she was trying to keep herself inspired. So then, you know, later on, she wrote this song. So, we got a special guest with us that just came into the studio. Could you introduce yourself to the listeners, please?
My name is Kara Huang. I work at City College of New York, and I just here for the summer to visit.
Okay, and you were here last year, weren't you, during the Interdependent Film Festival?
Yes, one of my film, Free Trade Refugees from Chiapas to the Prairie, was screened during that film festival. And it's about a group of Mexican migrant worker from Chiapas, particularly. They cross to come to United States only after NAFTA. So they are fairly new compared to other group. And there were about 100 people in the United States in this small, from this small village of 1,000 people. And Maria Silva and I observed them and record their life for about 11 years.
Okay. Yes, Maria Silva was a longtime Champaign Urbana activist from Ecuador originally, and she yes. moved back to Ecuador about 5-6 years ago.
Yes, she actually returned and I think she completed her PhD.
Okay.
So she is now return to Ecuador.
Okay.
To
work. I saw her before she left, and I said, hey, maybe now that Carrera got elected, you can become the ambassador and maybe be stationed at the consulate in Chicago, you know. Yeah. But anyway, your film documents this odyssey, if you will, the hardship, basically, and you premiered the film last year. So what's been, I mean, you were telling me when I ran into you the other day that there's been some lot of interesting, unfortunately, though tragic stuff that's happened since last year. With the characters of this film,
Most recent issues. Of course, we discover a lot of through the 10, 11 years that we observe them, we observe a lot of difficulty happen to those people who only have, their children are American citizens because they're born here.
Mm-hmm.
The majority, I think all the adults are still undocumented.
Okay.
So the subsistence life, of a undocumented, people in the rural area in Illinois is really harsh. Yeah.
And they do mainly agricultural work?
They do mostly, they do everything.
Mm-hmm.
But majority of them, do factory work.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So they went through temp agency, and the temp agency, of course, placed them,
mm-hmm.
and then they take a cut of their pay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, at the mercy of where could they be placed. And usually there are a lot of age discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, age means that when you reach 45 years old, you pretty much sit on the bench at 5 o'clock and you won't be called.
Mm-hmm.
And if you continue for a month, you become very depressed.
Yes.
Because you have a family to raise, and then you went out there every day at 5 o'clock. But you are not called in, and then you know your job is done,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to skip town. So it's a very difficult situation for them. They have no means of survival, so they will do any kind of work. They will do roofing, they will do, you know, gardening,
mm-hmm.
they will do any kind of job that could survive.
Yes. Now, mm-hmm. when you did this, I mean, what I find interesting is that this film was 10 years in the making, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's quite a project.
Well, it's kind of like Boyhood, and then 56 of in Britain, you know, kind of you return to these group of people and then watch how they how their life transformed them, or how they, you know, how they live their lives. And it's a great learning experience for me, because when Maria and I first started the project, we asked them, what do you want to do? And they said, we want to tell people our life, you know. So to hear our voice here, what we have to say, because everybody say about us, but, you know, actually we have no voice. It was fine, okay. So we started going out there almost every weekend for about 10 years before I left for New York to work.
Okay.
So we record huge amount of their lives. And when it come to editing, we face a huge problem, because PBS documentary probably is just 55 minutes, and we have like 120 hours.
Oh, yes, that's quite an editing task.
So I actually, through the year, Berea and I cut several versions, and we cut it into like 4 hours and 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then after she left, I work on it, and I cut it into 2 hours and a half. And then Bogdan, our editor, cut it into 71 minutes.
Wow.
So it's
I hope it did justice.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, good.
Yeah, we got a very wonderful editor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so when you return to New York here in another week or two, what are some of the projects you've got lined up in New York City?
I work with... in the city, I'm part of the Asian American and Asian Research Institute.
Mm-hmm.
We work with Murphy Institute, which is a worker education institute of CUNY, and it's a basic mission is to educate the workers organizer in the
okay.
city.
Mm-hmm.
So the core supporter of the Murphy Institute. It's in the pipeline of students that came from the city's union. And so it's very exciting to have. They were on the 18 and the 19th floor, and Asian American and Asian Research Institute is on the 10th floor. So they have a project with China, pretty much it's just to educate an NGO, organizer in China through, collaborating with two universities in China and try to train them. And now I think it moves to more of the online service or online kind of matching up the curriculum and also matching up the policy. China has the best labor law, but the issue is how to implement it. Okay, so if you apply law, you don't know where to go. So therefore, the issue is to educate the workers. That's their right because they are not informed or they are not aware of. And so the NGO is doing a lot of work after the labor, huge amount of labor dispute 2 or 3 years ago.
Yes.
Many workers commit suicide just in protest of the
Yes, there were like hundreds of wildcat strikes, and some of them were very violent, you know, in which they killed management and owners of companies. I mean, what pushed somebody to that point? You got to wonder. I mean, they must have been horrible conditions.
The issue, I think, is the long working hours, and then they're looking for longer hours work because everybody needs money.
Yes.
But the problem is if you work extensively for such a long hours without sleep or without rest, then you endanger yourself.
And that's what I was going to say too about that monotonous work. You know, you're doing it for a long stretch of time, and it's that and this particular task that you do repeatedly over and over again.
And also there was a lot of strikes over safety issues too, I believe. I think there was a couple of mining disasters and some other industrial disasters that led to some of those. But you know what's interesting is how much New York City has got, if I'm not mistaken, a fairly large Asian undocumented immigrant population. Do you do any work in helping Asian undocumented workers in the New York City area?
Yes. I participate, and I can also help, participate in a community watch, kind of community watch and organizing work in Flushing after a woman, a student from China was murdered mercilessly on the street and without, you know, people watch her without helping her.
Oh, wow.
And that was a very harsh situation for the community to swallow. So after that, my friend Michael Chu organized a community night watch. So they walked the neighborhood from Monday through Friday from 8 to 10. And the organizing way was rather interesting because majority of the people who participate in the walk are new immigrant, maybe without document or maybe with document. We don't know.
Yeah.
But the organizing way is to just to get a cell phone number, and then they will assign you a number. And then the organizer will call and say, would you like to walk tomorrow night? And then you showed up, you got a bottle of water, you got a vase and say, community walk. And then you walk the darkest part of Flushing. And I make everybody in the walk aware of their neighborhood. So it's a great education for a lot of immigrants that probably do not know about the neighborhood. In the winter time when it's too cold to walk, they Michael drive two vans. So he has a travel agency, so he just drives the van, and then the people who usually new immigrant doesn't drive in New York City, the immigrant population pretty much use the subway. So they tour the whole neighborhood in Flushing, and then they flush the lines, a community watch, and they will inform the police or intervene somehow if something some things that they saw in the community that are, you know, endanger other people, they will get involved. So that's the part that I involve. I am currently working with them as a action research paper that I'm going to write about them. And it involves almost 1,000 people.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Every night, I think about 15 to 20 people walk. Through the years, three or 4 years, they contribute almost 4,000 or 6,000, four to 4,000 hours of the community people who engage in the walk.
Is there a website that you could refer listeners to find out more about both your film and kind of what you're doing in New York City?
Yes, for the film is just Carol Fung Hilm. You can Google it, and it will lead you to the website. It's not well constructed yet because But I'm going to improve it through the summer and maybe through the fall. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on the World Labor Hour, and good luck in New York City and everything. And if something comes up that you'd like to, you know, let the listeners know about while you're there during the course of the, you know, the fall, winter, and then the spring, just give me a contact and we'll get you on the air sometime.
Sure. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much. You're listening to World Labor Hour. We'll be right back.
One, two. She told me the state is my enemy. The lady on the left saying property is theft. A year in the slammer couldn't keep her mouth shut. J. Edgar Hoover couldn't move her from my heart. I'm talking Emma, Emma, Emma Goldmine. About the meaning of the black flag. She said, if I can't dance, it's not a revolution. They ran her out of town just to keep her mouth shut. J. Edgar Hoover couldn't move her from my heart. I'm talking Emma, Emma, Emma Goldmine.
Okay, we're back. That was Ann Feeney again, Emma Goldman. And anyway, we are going to talk about some other, I think, very important issues here. Gus?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest elephants in the room in terms of what's going on with the 2016 elections. I mean, at this point now, this has really become just a mega storm already before the primaries. You have 16 Republican candidates. That's unheard of. And then you have, of course, Hillary Clinton. You have Bernie Sanders. I mean, these are very two distinctive candidates right now that America has not seen.
Who's the other Democrat? God, I can't remember his name.
Chafe? I think it starts with a C.
Okay. I never heard of him before.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what's interesting about this race is that it's such a very unique group of people that are running. So the question remains for us as the everyday people, what do we want from these people? What do we want them to do? Because right now they're running on we're going to give you our platform. We're going to give you what we think you need. And we all know that being as people who live in communities that live in issues that have to do with race, class, gender, sexuality, things like that, we should be able to develop our own issues and platforms that we give to our public servants. Because right now, the Democratic Party especially, we already knew the Republican Party wasn't going to address a lot of things like race.
Mm-hmm.
But right, a lot of people are very surprised at how the Democratic Party has been handling the issues of 2015 and 2014 in terms of police violence and violence against African-American people. I mean, so what this is really is just to kind of talk about what Bernie Sanders and what Hillary Clinton have been doing in terms of race.
Okay.
Because what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to seriously challenge these two individuals, because more than likely the way it's looking based on the polls, Hillary right now is slaughtering the Republicans in polls. And again, I know polls are not very accurate and all that stuff, but let's be clear.
Yeah.
She has a lot of strength in her candidacy right now.
Yeah.
But if she's elected without us having to challenge her, then we're failing ourselves at this point. So
okay.
Protest against racist police murder, like, you know, things about from Mike Brown to Sandra Bland. You know, these things have helped sound the alarm about the systemic abuse and violence against Black America that we face on a daily basis. But this Black Lives Matter, are Democrats really listening? Bernie Sanders, who was the self-identified socialist senator from Vermont and candidate for the Democratic Party, demonstrated as much as the liberal Netroots Nation, demonstrated as much at the liberal Netroots Nation conference, a showcase for progressive Democrats held in Phoenix in July. When confronted by Black Lives Matter's protests, who wanted the presidential campaigns to begin addressing the issues of racism and police brutality, Sanders kept right on talking, acting as if the activists were hecklers. This was an opportunity for This was a key opportunity for Sanders, who took part in civil rights protests against segregation in the 1960s. He was there. He was part of the movement in civil rights, but has yet to say much about racism during his Democratic primary campaign half a century later to finally address the concerns and questions of African Americans and anti-racists. Instead, Sanders stuck to his script, and this is a historical issue with the Democratic Party. They have their platform script that they are trying to give to the people. We need to reject that platform, and we need to offer our platform to them because they are our public servants. That is key. So the protest at least seemed to have made an impression on Sanders. A few days later, after some backlash, he made a statement about Sandra Bland, the Black woman who died in custody in Texas jail, where she was held for 3 days after her brutal arrest for a minor traffic violation. The problem with his statement, though, I quote, "This video highlights once again why we need real police reform, reform, reform. People should not die from minor traffic infraction. Reform has happened in history. And what has happened? More repression, more death, more poverty. We have to go beyond reform at this point. We have to restructure the system. And that's the only way things are going to get done." So for Sanders being the so-called socialist that he claims to be, he sure likes to use the word reform a lot. I don't know too many real socialists and Marxists who use the term reform the way Sanders has been using it. And so we have to challenge him.
Some people, you know, use the word reform. They really mean, you know, to completely alter something, you know, but he should know better. I mean, he knows better than that.
And, and what's even worse about it are the things that Hillary Clinton has been doing. After Sanders was confronted in Phoenix, Hillary Clinton's handlers were quick to make sure she didn't make the same mistake she did a month before at an appearance at a Black church near Ferguson when she proclaimed "All Lives Matter," which is a complete and utter insult and disgrace to the Black Lives Matter activists and to African Americans everywhere who have worked so hard to put the epidemic of racist violence against our people in the spotlight. Clinton sought to cast herself as more engaged on race issues than Sanders, telling Washington Reporter, I quote, "We need to acknowledge some hard truths about race and justice in this country. And one of those hard truths is that racial inequality is not merely a symptom of economic equality. Black people across America still experience racism every day." But no matter what Hillary Clinton says, keyword says, about racism in America today, what she actually represents can be found in the record of the Democratic Party and its decades of taking Black supporters for granted while never making good on its promises. I'm a firm believer in judge a person on their actions and not their words. And the Democratic Party, their history shows that they are talkers. They are not walkers. That's a major problem. So a look at President Bill Clinton's record on issues that impact Black America reveals just how little the Democrats have done in exchange for the overwhelming support they get from African Americans at every election. In fact, Clinton, who was hailed as the first, and those that can't see me, I'm putting my fingers up to do quotations because I totally disagree with this, the first Black president, made everyday life for Blacks significantly worse. Let's do some history. Provisions in the two Clinton-era crime bills, which Hillary Clinton actively campaigned for, put more cops on the street and enforced tougher mandatory sentencing for non-violent offenders like drug possession, among other things. This kicked the era of mass incarceration, as author Michelle Alexander calls it, into high gear. Or what, you know, she calls it the new Jim Crow. I call it the new nadir. We're far beyond Jim Crow at this point. We're into apartheid-like conditions. That's the problem. So larger and larger numbers of poor and working class people, disproportionately black and brown, found themselves under the control of the criminal justice system. And this was under the Clintons, and this was under the Democratic Party.
And these were like mandatory sentencing and all sorts of other things other than what you just mentioned. Yes.
I mean, and what you really have, and just kind of putting it into a more generalized standard of what has happened since Bill Clinton was put in office in 1992, the Clinton administration has capitalized on racialized hysteria about crime to push the crime bills, but it also exploited stereotypes to rationalize gutting government spending on social services like welfare. Using rhetoric about personal responsibility, this Reagan-type nasty racist idea that people need to pull themselves up from their bootstraps, and they shouldn't be doing these types of criminal acts and all this other stereotypical nonsense they spew. Clinton got legislation passed that imposed strict time limits and work rules on welfare recipients and threw untold numbers of poor people off the rolls.
And this happened even when he was a governor of Arkansas. Before he became president. Yes,
exactly.
And what was the famous, I don't remember all about it, but there was some kind of exchange between Queen Latifah, the rapper, and Bill Clinton. What was that all about? Where he insulted her or something, and even a lot of African American people applauded Bill Clinton for it.
Exactly. And that's the thing that gets me, because, and the problem with it is, we have to look at it from a structural standpoint. Why did they do that? It's because we are forced to have a two-party system, and you either are for one and against one, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it works. So supporting this Democratic Party means that for a lot of people, I'm against those Republicans because they're racist. That's a problem. We cannot think in those terms. The Democrats are basically just soft conservatives.
And co-opters.
They
co-opt every single movement out there. I mean, in my lifetime anyway. You look at it. I mean, they basically, it's where movements go to die once they go in the Democratic Party.
And again, this isn't just us talking about we're not just talking about our own political ideologies. We're basing what we're saying and the stuff on the show on the history of the Democratic Party. These are the things that they have historically done. And they have not shown in this primary race so far that they're going to change that method based off of what Bernie Sanders is doing, and especially what Hillary Clinton is doing. Let's not go into her bank accounts, her foreign bank accounts, the stuff with the Walmart that she's on the board or whatever she does with them. She makes money off of them.
Yeah.
And she's supposed to be so-called pro-labor and all this stuff. So many contradictions that exist. So again, what I'm saying is that I'm not saying that you should just totally just disapprove of everything. But what we can do to make this better is to challenge Sanders, to challenge Clinton, so that the platforms that we present to them, they can start pushing forward. Because right now they're just trying to get by. They're trying to get by on the same Democratic historical trend of just doing whatever they wanted, and to continue to co-opt and to make privatization the core of American society.
Yes, further privatization. I mean,
exactly.
Indeed. And, you know, this is some really good points. That's really disturbing about Bernie Sanders on these two things. I mean, other than what you were just describing at that conference and, you know, stuff, and just everything that's been happening, I haven't really seen him out there in the forefront or anything. Like you said, he was in the civil rights movement. You'd think he'd have been out there, one of the first, you know, politicians out there on the front lines in Ferguson, you know. The other thing that bothers me about him is his foreign policy. I mean, it's no different than Hillary Clinton's or George Bush or any of the other neoliberal or neocons, really. Yeah. You know, he supports this, you know, he hasn't come out ever and condemned the wars of any kind, and hasn't advocated for their, you know, bringing home the troops or none of that. You know, and this is, you know, a lot of people think, well, that's his foreign policy. Well, foreign policy is very important. I mean, because people don't realize it does affect you. It affects what's available here at home as far as resources. I mean, this whole militaristic society, and but I mean, it's a combination of the military and corporations. You know, they're basically eating up all of our resources. You know, and again, they interact. I mean, the more war out there, the more people make money off of it. You know, I mean, you know, the wealthy, the corporations and stuff. And who is it that go fight these wars? It's poor and working class kids. Mm-hmm. You know, so these are good points, Gus. And I really like the focus you went on about as far as, you know. Let's not let them off the hook, and let's give them our issues, not just take them as a packaged product and just say, well, okay, it's either product A or product B. I guess I'll take product B.
Because that's how we can really find out who these people are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we offer, and we demand these issues, since they are supposed to be our public servants, we tell them what the issues are and we make them talk about race.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make them talk about race, which is, I know it sounds bad that we have to make mm-hmm. public officials talk about it, but we have to force them to do it and challenge them, because that's when the true colors will come out. We're going to find out who Bernie Sanders is. We're going to find out who Hillary Clinton is.
Yes.
We have to do that. And that's the only way we're going to be able to address this issue, because the crisis is rising. We're still over 500 plus police murders right now against everybody, not just black people, but everybody
yep.
now.
Yep.
I mean, the trend is growing now at this point. Violence against African Americans and brown people, I mean, it is skyrocketing, and it's not going down anytime soon. There was almost another rebellion at the University of Cincinnati because of what happened with that young man who was gunned down by the officer who was charged with murder or manslaughter or whatever they gave him with. Again, this is not something you can do by just putting a person in jail. There has to be a complete restructuring of the system so that policies and practices cannot be based on traditional racist thought and stereotype,
yes.
that, like what I just talked about with the Democratic Party, has used when Clinton was president to push these very horrible crime bills that have destroyed the poor working base people and African Americans.
And let's and here's something else you can throw in the mix of Bill Clinton's track record: NAFTA, China Trade Preference Bill. How many good paying and unionized, unionized and non-unionized, what good paying manufacturing jobs were lost in this country? I mean, in the millions because of this. And at the same time, put a damper on raise increases in the manufacturing sector in general, to the point to where the average manufacturing wage in the United States now is 20% lower in real terms than it was in 1994.
Mm.
You know, so I mean, that's hit the African American community and other communities hard. Let's talk also about the Glass-Steagall Act. I mean, that opened the door for the 2008 financial crisis with mm-hmm. all this deregulation. And you know, I know it's kind of a little bit of a roundabout one, but the whole Media Reform Act, in which it allowed more corporations to swallow up more, of the media, concentrating the media, which most people depend on for their information,
yep.
Even more. So, I mean, Bill Clinton, I mean, he's done more harm. There's been this trend since Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980. Actually, we could maybe even argue the last year or two of Jimmy Carter, that has been nonstop. Whether you have a Republican or a Democratic president in, it's just more and more austerity, more and more less democracy, more and more repression, the trend's continuing.
I think the major problem, if we really want to look at Bill Clinton from a critical eye, from 1992, he represented such a dramatic shift from personality wise from the Reagans and the Bushes,
yes.
that so many different working people just fed into it.
Well, I'll speak from experience. After 8 years of Reagan and 4 years of Daddy Bush,
exactly,
we were desperate for somebody else.
Please bring me in. It's the same thing what a lot of people did, unfortunately, with Quinn and Rauner.
Yeah, and Obama. You think about it. I mean, and this, you got to wonder if this is not a planned strategy on the part of the ruling class.
Of course. Like I said, they're not the ruling class because they're not smart.
Yeah.
They understand strategies and how to do things,
and they've got centuries of experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So like I said, the major thing that I want to get out of this for our listeners is that we have to try to spread the word that we need to challenge the Democratic Party to address the issues that we feel are important to us, not what is important to them. Because right now, we all know that race is something that is ticking in America. But the two Democratic presidents, primary candidates, who have a really good shot at becoming the next president for the next 8 years,
mm-hmm.
are not talking about it. What does that tell you, how they feel about you, if you're African-American, if you're Latino, if you're a woman, if you're anything that is different from the ruling class elite group? What does that tell you how they care about you?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, it feels as though they don't care. And
yeah.
that's why we have to start challenging them to find out if they do or not. Because we don't know now. But when we find out, then we can get rid of them if they don't care.
Yes, indeed.
And we can go for somebody else.
Okay, now We got about 5 minutes here. I don't know. Yeah, we talked about this before the show. I was really surprised earlier in the week to stumble across an actual action by a graduate employees union out in California, United Auto Workers. They're organized by the United Auto Workers, Local 2865. That's actually is 13,000 teaching assistants in this local. And anyway, they wrote a resolution they want to present to the national, well, I think first the state AFL-CIO to basically expel police unions from the AFL-CIO. Because of their long history of intervention in labor politics and complicity in racial violence, as they say here, quote unquote. And the UAW members say they want the cops union out of the country's largest labor federation. So, you know, this is really interesting. And I also found out that the national head of the Fraternal Order of Police is actually on the Homeland Security Advisory Board. Mm-hmm. You know, now, wow, that was, I don't want to say surprising, shocking though, you know, it was like, wow. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I've said it a few times on the show and I'll say it again. If we really want to get to the first component of restructuring the police system in this country, we have to do something about the police unions because they are the ones that are providing the support and security of police officers and police forces that commit these types of acts and are militarizing around the country. They're the ones that are doing that. They have the money and they have the popularity. They have the, mm-hmm. the ear of the government to do these things. And until we do something about that, because I don't see them as labor unions, as you know, what we think about AFL-CIO, ASME, things like that. I don't see them as that because what they're doing is they're first of all, they're representing mostly groups of people to dismantle working people's power,
yep.
you know, restrict mobility, things like that, things that the labor unions have historically wanted to fight for. The police unions haven't done that. Their history record is very shoddy on that.
Yeah.
So I'm so happy that they're actually trying to push this forward, and I hope it goes through. I support this 100%. Get them out of the AFL.
Yeah, I mean, even if it doesn't go anywhere, just the fact that no, this is being discussed over the internet yeah. and actual some concrete action taken shows a man. You know, despite all the bad news out there on a weekly basis, you see these little glimmers of hope, and it's like, you know, it seems like people are starting to fight back. It's just we need a lot more of it. It mm-hmm. seems, you know. But any parting words, Gus?
Is there anything going on this? Oh, this past. Oh yeah, definitely. Make sure you come out next weekend. It's Big Champaign Urbana Day. This is going to be exciting. The AFL-CIO is going to be out there. We're going to have a table out there. So if you want to learn any information or just learn about what the AFL-CIO is in Champaign County, what types of different opportunities there are in the building trades, the service trade, I mean, anything at all in terms of union work, just come out. I'll be out there. Also, the North End Breakfast Club, we will be out there, Champaign Urbana Day as well. So I'll be kind of rotating around the different tables. I'm just really excited about this because every year Champaign Urbana Days is really a phenomenal event. So many different community members come out to Douglas Park and so many different. It's just a great time.
Yeah, and that's next weekend?
Yes, the 7th and the 8th.
Which is Friday and Saturday?
Yep.
Okay, and do you know what the times are roughly? Or
On Friday night, it's going to be Friday evening. Mm-hmm. I don't have the time, but on Saturday, it's going to start, I believe, at 10 o'clock.
Okay, very good. Well, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on the supported community radio station WFT in Champaign. Stay tuned for the Union Edge. And in the meantime, be safe and power to the people. Take care.
To the Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. For more information about the show, go to theunionedge.com.
This is Solidarity News on Radio Labor.
This is a Radio Labor news update recorded on Wednesday, July 29th, 2015. I'm Mark Belanger. The world is facing a long period of permanent unemployment and a dramatic shift to temporary part-time work. That's the conclusion of the International Labor Organization. The ILO is the UN agency which is concerned with matters of work in the world. It is very strongly supported by labor unions, mainly because it is operated in a tripartite fashion by representatives of governments, employer groups, and labor unions. The ILO has announced that its priority over the next few years will be to study the changes in the world of work especially permanent unemployment, and come up with solutions. Guy Ryder is the Director General of the ILO. He is the first unionist to head the organization in its 96-year history.
We are seeing record rates of unemployment in the world, unemployment which is over 200 million in the world. And despite everything that has been said about global recovery of the economy, the global employment rate, which is going to continue to increase, it is not going down, it is continuing to increase. And our projections for the future are